it was probably a very good grounding in serving my time, because you had to make do with a lot of things. And in years later, I realised how good it was. The man who owned the place was a man called George Dean, who had previously worked in Guinness's. He was a pretty tough man, and his co-director was a man called George Fisher, who had great connections in Irish Shell and BP. The majority of the work was letterheads and business cards for Shell and BP. And also, the George Dean brought some work from Guinness's. We've done double diamond labels, mm-hmm. and we've done the labels for the Guinness's bottles as well. It was a small jobbing house.
Were they actually designed there by yourselves? Or
no,
were they?
No. The labels would come in as plates. They were actually just printed there. I would, as a compositor, I would not have anything to do with that. I would have been more into doing agreements with the Shell garages and the BP garages, just the text of it, of agreements, heavy legal jargon, and the text of that. That's what I would have been more into. Making up business cards, we'll say catalogues, a shoe catalogue for Norvik shoes, which were ladies' shoes. At that particular time...
What year was that?
That was in 1959. At that particular time, you had to serve 6 years. The year before I started was 7 years of an apprenticeship, but it was reduced to 6 years. And this firm was taken over by a consortium at the time of Cherry and Smallridge, was one of the companies which operated down, I think, in East Wall, and Guy's of Cork. They formed a conglomeration and they bought over Dublin Print and Paper Company, with the result that they built new premises down in Alderbrook Parade, down off the North Strand, the Five Lamps down there, which was a lot better than what we had been used to up in North Frederick Street.
Now, the printing works, when you were there at the beginning, the company that ran that printing works, the management, who were they and what were they like?
George Dean was the man from Guinness's. He was a small man, and looking back, I would call him a tyrant. I will tell you a story as I move along about George. Mr. Fisher was the traveller, and he was a very genial man and a lovely tall man, Northern accent, and very, very nice. But the managing director of the place was George, and he was very, very tough, very tough altogether.
And how many employed there at the time?
There would have been one man out of his time and one apprentice in the case room. And in the machine room, there was three machine minders and one apprentice in the machine hall, and one paper cutter, and four women in the bindery who looked after the finishing of the jobs. That would be the binding and the the perforations and putting holes in paper and various things like that.
Well, you know, when you look back at those days, it was a lot, so different. Everything was hands-on, wasn't it?
Certainly was, yeah.
And, you know, with the printing, it was slow work, it was tedious work.
Tedious. It wasn't tedious work. I was delighted with it. I threw myself into it. Hand setting was at the time. And you went from 6-point type, which was fairly small, up to 48 or poster type, as it was. As I earlier said, the firm hadn't got an awful lot of material, so I was sent off to friends of the managing director to borrow type and borrow this and borrow that. It was run on that level. I'd be on my bike half the day going round getting
where
type.
Where would you borrow it from?
The Juverna Press, which was down on Liffey Street. The Bohemian Press, which was up beside Dalymount Park. And he seemed to have contacts in various areas. That type, I'd bring it back down on the bike, and then when it was finished with, brought back up to the particular firm that it was borrowed from.
So you were borrowing what?
Type.
Yeah.
It'd be mostly typed, the letters. And most of that was all handset. In the case room where I was, there was no machine setting at all. It was all handset. So you had the frame, we worked at a frame, which had the case of type in it. And the cases were pulled out. You had a stick, which you held in your left hand, and into the cases you went around picking out the particular letters that you needed to make up the sentences of the words. Now, as you can see, you had to read it backwards. You were working backwards from it, because as you started from the left. You had the stick in your left hand. You worked from the left to the right. So the type, you were reading the type backwards all the time.
Yeah. Now, how long did it take to get used to doing that kind of work?
There was a great variety. It went from business cards to, we'll say, letterheads, to doing a brochure or booklets and things. The variety, they were called jobbing houses, which in itself, that variety was there. It wasn't a book workhouse. A jobbing house had a variety of materials.
Your apprenticeship, how long did it
take? 6 years. It took 1959 to 1965.
Yeah. But continue anyway. The business was taken over by this new
Guy of Cork and Cherry and Smallridge. So there was some money pumped into it, and there was a Linotype acquired, and a Ludlow. A Ludlow was a hand kind of setting machine, but it has the metal effect. It's for doing display type. That'd be the larger faces. Display faces would be larger than the Intertype, and the Linotype was for setting the main body of a book, or the main body of text in any pamphlet or anything like that.
And you know, when you look at the old methods of engraving,
yes.
It was all steel engraving. But did you ever do any woodcuts or linocuts or?
No, not didn't do woodcuts, but if you were pressed into it, yeah, we done the lino cuts with a sharp knife, and they wouldn't be very, what would I say, they wouldn't be very artistic. They would be bare. If you wanted a circle, or if you wanted a square or something like that, or a cross, you might do something with a lino cut, but nothing as intricate as some of the great artists would do.
Yeah, but you know, some of the brochures, were they elaborate brochures? Were they?
They were. They would have been. Yeah. One particular one that I think I worked. It was the first big one I worked on was Joe Walsh Tours brochure. Joe Walsh at the time was only starting out, and the plates of all the foreign places and the so exotic. People here wouldn't have been away an awful lot, but to see all these lovely, beautiful places. The plates come in, and each picture was made up of four plates. You had CMYK, it would have been called. That's cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. And they were printed on the printing machine in separate colours. So to get the brochure done, it went through the machine four times.
How long did that work continue for?
Well, I served my time for, as I said, 6 years. When I was coming out of my time, normally what was done in the printing trade, you worked for over the rate. Everybody was on different. You had the union rate, and then people, depending on how skillful or how good they were able to make an extra few shillings by going in. And normally it would be £1 over the rate, £2 over the rate, or £3 over the rate. So there was a strike in 1965 in the printing trade, and I came out of my time during a strike. Now, to be allowed to work during the strike, you had to pay £3 a week out of your wages to the union to help keep the men who were out on the streets. So that was going on, that was fine. So I thought it'd be an ideal time to go into Mr. George Dean and ask him for a rise. I wanted some money over the rate. So I went into him and I asked him for £3 over the rate. Well, he exploded. He told me he had taken me in off the street and put shoes on my feet and to get out of that office as quick as I could. So with a strike on, I couldn't do much more. back down to the floor, feeling very chastened. So, lucky enough, within 4 weeks, the strike was over. And we had a book which went around to all. A delegate went down to Gardiner Street. Gardiner Street was the union offices, 35 Gardiner Street. The name of the union was the DTPS, the Dublin Typographical Provident Society, which only covered Dublin. There was only 1,000 members in it. And each Monday night, a delegate from every printing house in the town went down there and discussed what was happening in the trade and what action would be taken on this, that and the other. And anywhere there was a job vacancy was put down in a book. So this book went around of a Tuesday morning in the jobs. And so as soon as the strike was over, there was a job advertised in the Sign of the Three Candles. And I promptly went across to the Sign of the Three Candles. And I was given the job. I was asked could I start immediately.
And that place was called?
The Sign of the Three Candles.
And why was that a religious place?
No, it wasn't. It was owned by a very great, I would say, Irish man. Colm O'Loughlin was his name. And Colm O'Loughlin had printed material. He would have printed stuff for the Eucharistic Congress, Cunran na Gaeilge. Most of he was a great Irish Catholic man, I would say, and he ran his printing house. It was a bookshop, more or less, than a jobbing house. He would have done books. But I really found when I went in there, it's where I really learned about books and came to have a great love of books, because he'd done them in the old traditional way. And he used some of the classical fonts of type that we would have used, Baskerville and Plantin, Times Roman as well known. And I really, really enjoyed working in the Sign of the Three Candles.
Now, there was another printing works in Dublin, Coola Press at the time, and they did printing, as you know, in the old format. Now that was a craft in itself.
Yes.
And you were saying that that the style was very special. What about the covers of the books? Were they leather bound, or were they?
They were indeed. They had normal printing houses, you would have a bindery, and in the Sign of the Three Candles, the binderies in most of the other houses would have been made up of women, but in the Sign of the Three Candles there were men, there were craftsmen. They had served their time as binders, and they'd done some beautiful one-off works with leather covers and the gold leaf and embossed into it, which was absolutely fantastic to watch. I think a lot of the craft and the skill went out of it because of the cost. These manuscripts and ledgers and type of work would have cost a terrible lot of money.
Was there any particular book that you worked on that you remember as being a very special book?
I have, over the years, would this be over the years? I have done a book for the South Dublin County Council, and it was done in the year 2000, and it was called the Millennium Book, and they went around the schools and they asked the schools to do out sentences or something that happened from the year 1 to the year 2000. And I think there was about 5 or 6 schools, and I collated all the material and set it with the help of 1 or 2 other people. And I designed the book, designed the type. I used a type which would bring you back to the Sign of the Three Candles, because Colm O'Loughlin designed a typeface which was called Columbkill. And with the computers now, they have a typeface on the computers which was called Columbkill. And I used that typeface in this book. There was only 40 of them printed, and they are ensconced in, I think there's one up in Corporate Services, and the libraries, I think, have one each. And that would have given me the greatest pleasure doing that route, because it was leather bound as well, and there was the gold leaf on the front of the cover.
Working in that skillful job for many years, you know, it must have been very hard then to have, you know, to walk away from it.
After that was early on in my career. One of the things, if I could just say to you, there was always work available in the Independent and the Irish press, for the simple reason that it was night work, and you worked 13 nights out of 14. You had one night off in 14 nights, and a lot of the men, what they would do would be work overtime that night. So if you had a family and you were growing up, you steered clear of most of the men in Dublin wouldn't have gone into the, there were some, all right, that went into it, but most of them wouldn't go into it. They went around normal trade houses and they had day work. Even night work in some of the houses, it only meant 5 nights a week, and you could start at 8 o'clock at night and you'd be finished at maybe 7 in the morning. But the Irish press was completely different. And each morning you'd finish maybe at 3 o'clock and you could be asked to work overtime till 7 again. That was on 13 nights a week. A lot of money, but if you liked the work-life balance, you wouldn't.
What year did you go into the Irish press?
I went into the Irish press in 1979. I had, over the years, you make friends, and the print trade is funny in this respect, that people seemed to move to jobs together. There was various roles people went. And there was 3 of us who knew one another well. We played football together and we socialised together. So if a job came up in some place, one of us would tell the other fella. And I was told there was a job in the press, would I be interested in it? And I went down. I was interviewed in the front office in Burra Quay by a man called Sean Donnelly, who's still alive. I'd say he's in his 80s now, and a nice man. And the words he said to me, he said, you're looking for a job? And I said, yes. He said, well, Don Rooney is after recommending you. And I said, well, I know Don for a while. And he turned around and he says, well, you know, that's no recommendation. And he said, when can you start? So that was the interview for the job in the press. And I started in there in 1979. And I found it completely different to what I was used to. It seemed to be all go. Everything was in a hurry, and it was thrown together, and it was completely different to what I had been used to.
Because the book business was more laid back.
Yes, it was indeed. Yes, you had more time, and you looked at the margins, and you made sure there was no widows and orphans in the pages. And but in the newspapers, get the paper out. The paper had to meet the train at I think it was 12:30 in the morning, the Mallow train at 12:30. If it didn't meet that, they had to send out about 10 lorries on the road. And you can imagine the extra expense that would be. So there would be murder if it didn't meet the trains.
Yeah, now the Irish press was a great paper in its day.
And it was indeed.
It had the staff working were great people. Any of those people come to mind?
Yes, they certainly do. I haven't got the paper, but I would do Con Hoolan's column. Con Hoolan's writing wasn't very, very good, wasn't great. And he would write a paragraph. 2 lines would be a paragraph to Con Hoolan. And he would write each paragraph on one sheet. So Con Hoolan's article would be, I'd say, about 2.5 to 3 inches thick. So it was divided up between 2 or 3 people, and I was fortunately one of the people that was given it. The writing was difficult to read, but after a while you got used to it. And there was a time when he was doing his article, he made a mention of the 3 people who done his article for him, and he was very, very pleased with it. He was a great character, he was, you know. Larger than life, and what I would say to about a good trade unionist, a good man. Not the trade unionist anymore, but a good man. He didn't like seeing anybody being. I'm not saying abused, but wrong being done to them. He didn't like that.
When you were working on his writings that were coming in, did you get a feel for his style?
You would, and it was an amazing how he could go from Ballinagashel, or Knocknagashel is where I think he was born, Knocknagashel. He could go from Knocknagashel and then talk about some player or an opera, and then talk about some hurler. It was, or a ballet, and he was a man of immense reading and intelligence. He could relate one thing to another, and you could see exactly where he was going and how good the performance must have been, the way Con had it put down writing, you know.
When you met Con, how did you find him? He would often come into you, would he?
He would indeed, yes. But he was a terrible shy man. And at the best of times, it was very difficult to understand Con, or even hear what he was saying. He had a habit of putting his hand to his mouth, and with his hand in front of his mouth and the Kerry accent, it was pretty difficult to understand what he was saying.
And would he compliment you on the work that you were doing?
He actually did, and he had a habit of mentioning people in his articles, and three of us got a mention. I don't have the paper, but it's probably lying around somewhere.
And who were the other two?
Peter Lambert was one, and John Caulfield was the other man.
And moving on from Con, who else did you take particular liking to?
There was some. One of the things about the newspaper trade was there wasn't a great mix between the editorial staff and the printing staff. You would meet them having a pint in the White Horse or Mulligan's, but it was mostly separate. They were cut off in an area of their own, and the production end of it was, well, I'm not saying they didn't produce, but the printing end of it was further away. So there wasn't a great mix of people. While I was there, Tim Pat Coogan, I have, was editor. He was only editor for a short while. There was Power Play going on, and I think Pat got a push out. But in the editorial, Colm Rappel would have been another. I was a neighbour of Colm Rappel's. Colm Rappel lived beside me in 12 Croydon Gardens. I lived in 11, and we grew up together. So I came across him then years afterwards. He worked in The Independent for Tony O'Reilly, and he moved to the press then. So I would have met Colm Rappel in the press. Anybody else? The man that became the ombudsman, I think, is Mick Mills. Is that what I'll be right there? He became ombudsman. A very honest and a very straight man, and a very nice man. Very nice man to talk to.
Was there a great camaraderie between the lot of you inside there?
It was divided in two, and the division was those who took a drink and those who didn't drink. And on breaks, you started at 6 o'clock, and the first break was at 7:30, so you went out and you had a pint, and then at 9:30 you maybe had 2 pints. So the people who drank went out to the White Horse, Mulligan's, and had their pints, and those that didn't drink read their books or done what they wanted to do and stayed in the job. But they had an animosity towards the people who drank, because they assumed that the people who drank didn't do any work at all, and they would, if things were getting bad, they would be inclined to slow down and not pull their weight. But other than that, there was great camaraderie in there. Like, there was the golf societies, there was pitch and putt, there was a football team which we played in the printing houses cup. It was great socializing.
The politics that was going on in the background, were you aware of what was happening?
I would have been aware of what was happening. But at times you were more concerned with the paper and getting the paper out. You know, I was there when the Stardust fire happened on Valentine's night, and horror, it was horror. I was there when Ireland were doing well and the in the football. I was there the night Dennis, the snooker player, but I can't think of a second name, Dennis Taylor. The night he beat, he won the world title, and the whole of the press stopped to watch that, and I think the tie went on till nearly 2 o'clock in the morning, and there wasn't a stroke of work done that night. The Pope's visit, you were more concerned with getting the paper out, the things that happened, you knew about them, you knew about Charlie's days were numbered, and then Charlie had 9 lives and his days weren't numbered. You're seeing all these things, but your job was to get the paper out and the paper out at all costs. And as earlier I mentioned, the Mallow train, that was the number one.
There was always a deadline in there. Yes. And did you find the can you remember a situation where it was down to the wire, where you were waiting for maybe a report to come in, or you know, that things ran late?
They wouldn't hold the paper. It would be very seldom they would hold the paper for anything. It was most important to get it away. What they would do, would they would put the item into the next edition of the paper, say the city edition, or the early edition was the most important one for the country. The country got the early edition, and the city edition went around Dublin, which would have the full amount of material in it.
But was there a breakdown in the system then?
There would be breakdowns. Oh, sure, there'd be breakdowns. The takes would be given out, and linotypes were big, huge mechanical machines, and linotypes broke down. And when a linotype broke down and the copy was on that linotype, there was a delay. You had to wait for it. And then the stone men, they were there. The stone men would fairly, what would it say, rule the roost. They were the top hat men and the sword men who ruled the roost. And the paper would go down to the takes went down to the stone men on galleys, and they put them together. Take one, take two. There were small. Nobody got a big article to do. Nobody got a big article. Everybody got a small amount.
Who were the stone men?
Jimmy Barrow was one stone man, and there was another great character there called Willie Shakespeare. William Shakespeare. Where would you get a name like that? We call him Shaky, because he had a pretension to go out and get a few points on him, and he'd be shaking with that. But William Shakespeare, yes, and Jimmy Barrow, two great characters.
What about your editors, were they?
The editors, we would not see the editors. The overseer and the father of the chapel controlled the whole situation. The editors would have been NUJ people, and we would have been the at that stage the IGS, and later on the IPU it became, and there would be no interaction between editors and the people on the floor.
Did the newspaper in your time have a sequel that would go on from week to week?
What would I say? I suppose Dubliner's Diary was the main one in it. I'm not quite sure. I can't think of that. Michael Mill's done that for a while, Dubliner's Diary, now that I come to think of it. And that would have been the one sequel in it. Conn, of course, I think he had two columns during the week.
You spoke to me about that, and I sent you another PDF of it to see if you were happy with it so as I could get it printed. So do you want to see another copy of it? No, I sent it to the printers because I was out sick at the particular time, and if you wanted anything changed on it, he would have done it for you. Do you understand? So I was back then, and I was wondering why, and I sent you another PDF of it for you to check. So I'll send you one later on today, will I? And you can just tell me if you're happy enough with it. I'll get you quotes. The last copy of it. Yeah, well, that's great. That's grand. Okay, I'll send you another one anyway, and you just let me know, and then I'll get you quotes on how many you want and so forth. Okay, Niamh. Thanks a million to you. Bye.
You're a busy man.
Ah, sometimes. I'm not busy at this time.
Yeah.
I have patches during the year, and I guess up to my eyeballs, but at this time I'm okay with that, you know.
Well, going back to our chat, you were talking about the it must have been fascinating. I mean, you it was the adrenaline going all the time.
Not, I have to say, not really, not really.
Big story
There
would
was,
come in now or something like
well, the
that.
big story, it didn't, the big story wouldn't have anything to do with it. There was a noise and a smell in printing houses, the smell of the metal and the noise of the machines. And how I could relate the movement and things getting, you didn't have to look at the clock, you knew by the sound of the place. It was like how you describe soldiers going into war with the drummers in front of them, and the drum beat getting quicker and quicker, and the machines starting to move faster and faster. And you got caught up with this, and your speed started to rise as well, and the machines clanking and banging all over the place until about 12 o'clock at night. The paper had to go to the stone by 12, and that would be the last take. But the place would be a hive of activity at that particular time. And then just after 12 o'clock, everything would stop and there'd be a silence in the place, which was unbelievable, you know. That was your break then. It was break time. But you got caught up in it, and this noise and everybody running here, jumping up, grabbing takes, sitting down, setting it out, getting the tape, putting it back up, more, you know. And the noise, everybody knew what the time of the night it was by the sound of the machines.
And what about it was all night work that you were doing?
It was night work and day work. Luckily enough, when I went into the press, it was a 4-night week and a 4-day week, which was absolutely heaven. It meant you only worked every second weekend, which would be Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You'd be off Monday and Tuesday then in Wednesday, Thursday, and then off the next weekend. Compared to what I said earlier on about a 13-night fortnight, 4-day week, a 4-day week and a 4-night week was absolutely heaven. You'd done. Some people wanted to stay on night work and some people wanted to stay on day work. So there was a certain balance there. But if somebody wanted to go down on day work from night work, somebody would get forced up. It was a simple, and it was all run through a system, which was a fair system. The union ran it. That if you were on night work, say for a year, and somebody was up on night work for the year and they wanted to come down, you were gone up on night work. If you were on day work for a year and somebody was on night work, he wanted to come down, you were sent back up on night work, you know, after having your year on day work. So it was done in a fairly fair way, you know.
How many years did you remain in the press?
I was 12 years in the press, 79.
So you left before it was closed
I
down?
left before it was closed down. Closed in 1995. I left in 1991. 1991. At the particular time, the new technology was coming in. We were trained in sight and sound for word processors. The management of the press never asked anybody on the floor or anybody what type of new technologies they should go for. So they employed this American man who brought over a system which was completely the wrong system for the Irish press. And from the time that system came in, then there was an American company put in some money, and you had two camps fighting one another all the time. One camp would appoint somebody as as a manager, and the other camp would appoint somebody else as a manager. And from that day on, the press went down the glen, and they seemed to be more intent on fighting with one another. The Independent and the Times went in a different direction altogether. I think they went for Macintoshes, which I have here now at the present time, and they can be linked to one another. The computer they had in the press was a Honeywell, which was used for doing the wages. It was the length of three rooms, the Honeywell was, and they connected the setting up to this Honeywell. So you set it down on a machine, pressed a button, it went upstairs up to this Honeywell, and then it came back down to your machine and printed out on a printer upstairs as well. But it was an archaic scheme. It was something that a company in America was after getting rid of, and this man sold to the press. That's my opinion on it.
Was that the downfall of the press?
I believe that was the downfall of the press. They had money problems then as well. The sales, there was a time that the Sunday Press sold 300,000 copies. I think near the end of it, it would have been lucky if it was selling 19,000 or 20,000. So that you can see from that how the...
Why do you think the drop was?
First and foremost, I don't think they moved with the times. The tabloid papers were coming out. The press stayed with the old style type of paper. And most of the other companies were going down into... you had the Sunday World was after coming out at that time. The Herald was gone, tabloid as well. But the press stayed as they were. They weren't going to change at all. And I think that... people found it handier with the tabloid paper to read, to hold, to carry, rather than opening a big paper like the press was, the evening press. And the evening press stayed fairly buoyant for a good long time. The Irish press, the morning paper, that went down fairly quickly. You know, there wasn't great sales in that at all. Yeah. So I think that would have been one of the reasons.
Is that the reason why you left?
And then the infighting. Well, I kind of seen they were looking for, in actual fact, what they were looking for redundancies, and I couldn't see why they were looking for redundancies unless something was going to happen to the place. So I on the second lot of redundancy, I opted for redundancy, and I left at that stage. So after that, I was unemployed for a year or two. I said I was finished with the printing trade, and I tried to move in a sideways direction. And I answered many an ad, the courts as a porter, the solicitor's offices as a runner with letters and whatnot, and I found it very difficult to get a job. In some instances, people didn't even reply. In other instances, they wouldn't give you a reason. So my great idea, and then when I was sitting down to do CVs, I found that all I had to put on my CV was print. I had nothing else. I actually went for a truck driver's job one time, and I started off with the CV, and I said, well, what can you say about a truck driver? I can drive a truck. So I gave up that idea, and I was looking around for a while. I went down to the local community hall, and I was talking to people down there about getting back into work in different areas. And there was a lady down there, and she said to me, can you work a Macintosh? And I said, I can't work a Macintosh, but I can, I'm very good at setting and that. So she said there was somebody in the council looking for a Macintosh operator. So I said, fair enough. So I went up to Foss then, and they routed out a course over in Cabra, desktop publishing. It wasn't a basic course, it was a bit further on than that. So I applied for that, and they didn't want to take me. They said it was for people who had design, from the design colleges and various things like that. So I kicked up about it, and I suppose too, the people there were young. I would have been, I was about 54, 55 at the time. And I bit of ageism in it as well, but I kicked up anyway and I was accepted on the course, and it was one of the best things I ever done. I pick up things fairly easy, I can learn from books, and within 6 months I was flying. So I got the job in the council, which was only a fast job at that particular time, and after a couple of years working there, they seemed to like what I was doing, so they made me permanent anyway after that. So I've been here ever since.
You've got your own office looking out on the main street out there, and all your computer equipment around you.
Yes.
Tell me exactly what you're doing in this office now.
At the present time, I work on a varied amount of publications. One of the, I spoke about a book I'd done for the millennium, the year 2000 with the council. I also done, the council moved out here in 1994, and I'd done a year by year account of what the council have achieved and what they've done out here.
But this,
no, we leave out big.
It was very visual. This was it.
It was indeed. Yes,
stretched a long way.
It captured. It did indeed. It was. I would say there was about 5 meters in it, in a snake-like form. But it was a timeline of from 19, and within each section or segment, pictures and events that had occurred within South Dublin County at the in that year up to the year 2004. It was a 10-year thing.
Was this done on a display board?
Yes, it was a fairly big display board. Other than that, I don't do the annual report. There's an amount of work in South Dublin County Council that one particular person wouldn't be able to. I work for the corporate services, and they produce a magazine for the work, the employees of the council. I do a housing newsletter, which is delivered to 11,500 council houses, four times a year. I do a major magazine, again, which is for South Dublin County Council, which is delivered to house again. That's for the development department. I would do all kinds of books. I work for the South Dublin Libraries as well. I've done many a book for and Kieran Swords is a great pal of mine, a great friend of mine. And we have a great relationship and work, as well as a great bit of crack. So, anything else?
You've got a passion for your work. I can see it.
I love it. Yes, yes. I can remember. I had some bad times in it, but I love it. I love books, and. One of the things that was said years ago, when the linotype had come in, that it would do away with workers. But instead of the linotype doing away with workers, it made more work, because it was faster and it was able to do more setting. When the computer came in, we're talking about that we would never have to buy a book again. We could read our books on the computer. You know, Amazon and eBay and all them places, you can go on to it. But with the advent of the computer, it made the production of print and colour, particularly colour, so cheap that everything, there's nobody does black and white anymore, everything is in colour. So the computer has enhanced the life of books as well, and there's more books now being printed and published than has ever been, and that's thanks to the computer. Which was originally going to wipe them out. Nobody would buy a book again.
Looking back over your printing career, what are your ups and downs? What was the greatest achievement or the greatest moment of your printing career?
Greatest moment of my printing career. I'll tell you, one of the greatest moments of my was being made permanent in South Dublin County Council. I was really chuffed. I knew I wasn't going to be thrown out, but when my boss, Angela McDermott, came along and she said, we're making you permanent, that really gave me a worth, and it showed that people can see, I'm not saying a talent or anything like that, but that somebody is prepared to work hard, which I did work hard, and I was always available. My motto is, if I have to stay here till 10 o'clock at night to do the job, get it finished, if it's wanted tomorrow, there's no use having it the following day. You have to have it tomorrow. So you do what you have to do to get that publication out, or whatever it is, out on time. And time is the most important thing. Deadlines. I'm very into deadlines. So, and again, I that was one of the, I felt really great when I was told I was made permanent. The worst one was probably I worked up in Creation. I didn't mention Creation earlier on. Creation was Hugh McLachlan was the man who ran Creation. He used to run a printing house called The Fleet, and he was involved with, I don't know whether people remember, Shanahan and Singer. Paul Singer was the stamp man, and Shanahan's the stamps, the books of stamps. And there was a big scandal about the stamps, because he was selling them and they weren't worth what they were worth. But Hughie McLachlan was doing that work for them, and he got out of it on the right side without losing. They brought down, I think they brought down Shanahan stamps, and a few more businesses went by the way. But Hughie McLachlan got out of it with some money, and he started off Creation. And Vincent Brown worked with Creation. He had a magazine that was a fiery one at the particular 72 we're talking about. So the Northern Troubles would have been at their best. And Vincent Brown brought out a weekly magazine all about the troubles in the North. Then they started the, it'll come back to me maybe, but they also started the Sunday World then at that stage. So they split the firm up into two again, the people working on the Sunday World and those doing the magazines. We've done Woman's Way, Woman's Choice, Spotlight, which was a music magazine. He had great foresight in a lot of the things he'd done. It was mostly magazine work up there. Magazines. Then a man from the News of the World became involved, and we got English magazines then, the motoring magazines from England. So the place was generally flying. And then again, money problems hit, and the banks come in and put cages around the reels of paper, and the place went down. So what he done was, he took the Sunday World with a few of hand-picked men and went out to Terneur and started the Sunday World he kept it going up in Terneur with a few hand-picked people, and the rest of Creation went to the receiver. And we were made redundant. So we went up and we picketed the premises in Terneur, and of course we were removed by the police. But that was one of the lows, because it was a good job. There was good money and everybody worked hard, and it was great. Again, it was, I would have worked in smaller places, but Creation was big. There was 500 people, I'd say, worked in Creation, and that would have been one of the big blows. Again, it was out of work. And I have an old saying, people say anything, you know, be working in a job and something has gone wrong or there's trouble or whatever. And my saying is that I've been thrown out of better jobs than this, you know, so, which I have, you know, I've made redundant a couple of times. But you pick yourself up, dust yourself down and start all over again. So I'm here and I'm very happy. I'm 66 this year. No intention of retiring. I'll work here as long as they'll allow me to work here, and be happy with that. You know, I enjoy getting up in the morning.
Your schooling days. Where did the inspiration come for? For your future career to be.
I had, as I said earlier, I had all different types of books, engineering books. I was always out in the backyard opening up alarm clocks, trying to make an alarm. I'd get bits of string and pull the string here and open doors. You'd open the door and the alarm would go off on the alarm clock. I took the gears out of three speeds, ball bearings, put them back together again. I had an engineering flair. There's no question about that. I was good at mathematics in school. I was generally good at Irish. My father spoke Irish fluently, and he was away for a while, and we used to write to one another in Irish. I seem to have a liking for lots of things, but particularly I pay homage to Jack Glennon, who was my mother's half brother, and he lived with us for a good many years. And he worked in Veritas, and he had books of all kind. My house, my brother died a while ago, and the contents of the house were left to me by him, and I still have lots of the books that were there from years ago when I used to sneak up to his room and take the books and back down and read them.
Was it just the book itself, or was it the way that it was put together, the binding, the look of the book, and the feel of the book?
All kinds of books. There was more of the books. He had a copy of Mein Kampf, which I found it was like going through a ploughed field. I couldn't make head nor tail of it, particular age I was. He had murder trials, Craig and Bentley in London, who shot the policeman. The last woman to be hanged. There was a myriad of things. It was all kinds of magazines, books, and that. And I would pick them up. One of my favourite books would have been not the dictionary, but the dictionary as well, and a gazetteer of the world, Pears Encyclopedia. I'd read that. I had that beside me all the time. No matter what word I heard, I'd be into it or looking at anything and everything was in Pears Encyclopedia. So I got a fairly wide grounding. I was good in school. I got 7 honours in the intercert, and I passed in Latin. So
that's pretty good.
So which was, and again, the freedom young people have today, the whole thing was connected. My home was connected to the school, to the church, to St. Vincent's football, to playing in Fairview Park. It was a whole community at that particular time, I think. And you didn't stray out of it. You didn't stray out of it. Most people were done the same. The friends I had at the time, Tony McIntaggart, he went to New York and he was killed in a, he was only about 20, 22 years of age. Kevin French, Leo Fardell, who's still a friend of mine. And there's pictures of us in the football team, in the hurling team. Then we'd go down the park outside the house and play soccer, which was taboo at the time. If the Christian Brothers happened to be walking around, you were in for it. You were certainly in for it. And but running, representing your school, running Croke Park, playing in Croke Park. The people who played with Dublin at the time and the soccer players. I loved everything. I loved the rugby. I loved the soccer. I loved sport. And but I did get an all round education from home as well as school. I have to say I had some great teachers in the school. You know,
but you have nothing bad to say about the Christian Brothers.
They gave me a good education. There was sometimes I was in fear. I was never abused. I have to say, I've never abused. I got lashed on the hands and that. But you'd go to school sometimes in fear, you know, very not very afraid, but fearful of a cold morning. And you'd have your hands in your pockets trying to warm your hands before you got in at 9 o'clock, in case, you know. You got a biff for every shaveu missing or fodder missing, you know. Sometimes it was like that, but got through it, and I have nothing. They gave me a good education, you know. I would say that.
What
I worked in two jobs twice. I was never I never left a job on bad terms. I worked in the Three Candles twice. 1960, when I left where I served my time in 1965, I went to the Three Candles. And I stayed there till 1968. Then I went to Creation, which was up in Mount Brown at the time. And then they moved to the Players Factory over on Botanic Road. That's the same Creation. I went to England. I worked in England for 6 months down at... Printoni was the name of the place, and it was beside the east end of London, beside Millwall's ground, New Cross Road. I stayed there for 6 months, and my wife didn't like it over there, so I came back. And jobs were scarce at the time, so I went down to the Three Candles again, and I was taken back in there. Stayed there for another year or so, and then Creation again, back to Creation. Then they close. So it was very, there's an intricate movement in between there.
And Creation, when you went, you were telling me, when you arrived there, what was your brief? What were you doing there first?
In Creation?
Yeah.
Creation, as I said, had the magazines Woman's Way, Woman's Choice. And he was, the man McLaughlin was after being in Germany, and he figured out a new way. He was after bringing back litho machines. I worked all the time at letterpress, which was pressing the paper into the type. Litho was a new phenomenon here, and he went to, I think it was Romania, and he bought this, I think it was a 6 or 7 stage machine, which meant it could do 6 or 7 colours. And he was printing his Woman's Way and Woman's Choice in that. He brought back a new idea as well. Previous to that, the material would have been computer set and film made of it. But what he'd done was he bought this new film, which was a box of film. And what we'd done was we proofed it on a proofing press with normal ink. We rolled the type with ink, and you put this film on top of it and took a proof of it. The film was transparent, so he could go off and make plates with the actual film that we made. So it was fairly revolutionary at the time what he'd done. It didn't last long because the modern computers got rid of that fairly quickly. But he was a bit of an innovator in that sense. And all his machines, there was no letterpress machines in the house at all. He was the first man he bought, from Germany, he bought this huge machine that the Sunday World was printed on. And there was, I think there was 6 colours on that. 6 colour web offset was the first time. It was absolutely huge.
Do you remember working for a columnist or a journalist that would give you work to do, or
overseer?
Yeah,
it was the first time I realised why anybody was called an overseer, because he stood up on a box about. Now it wasn't just a. It had a front. It was like a pulpit. Exactly. That's it. It was like a pulpit, and he stood in the middle of the room.
Yeah,
or the case room, whatever it may be, and he was an overseer. It was
and
the first.
Was that,
it was the first time I ever realised what an overseer meant. Let me think of one or two of them. Hardy Pigeon was one. There was 3 or 4 of them. Tom Lockman was another, and there was another man, I can't think of his name, but he was. I don't know whether it's right. He was called Bungalow, and. People would ask, why do you call that man Bungalow? Well, because there's not much upstairs. And he got a hard time. And the workers would work for some of the overseers who were lenient. Those that started acting the big stick, we used to call it putting on the handbrake. You'd put on the handbrake for them, and they'd get the fright of their lives because the deadlines were coming and there was nothing happening, you know. So it helped to change. It may not be the right way to say it or the right thing to do, but that's the way it was. The good overseers would get the best out of you, and those that tried to wield a big stick didn't.
What about unions in the print?
The union, I always said it from day one. When I joined up, I went down before the union, and I can't remember exactly what it was. It wasn't an oath or anything like that. But you swore to uphold principles and be a good person and not bring anybody into or anything into disrepute and that. And the one thing I said about it was one of the most democratic unions I was ever in or ever seen. There was only 1,000 members, of course, which helped. But a delegate was sent down every Monday and issues discussed and problems sorted out, and everybody had a vote. At the end of the day, everybody had a vote. Years later, you'd have delegate meetings. You instructed the delegate and the local area. They would decide the matter without anybody having any. It was very tight knit, and everybody knew one another in it. The reason I gave the name earlier on. The IGS was, it changed from the DTPS to the IGS, the Irish Graphical Society, because they decided Dublin was too small. Small is pretty, but big has power. So they changed the name from the Dublin Typographical Society to the IGS, the Irish Graphical Society, and they sent men out around the country recruiting to try and build up the membership of the union. But it was so successful for a few years, but then the funds, I think, started running down, and eventually the union was taken over by SIPTU, and SIPTU just, you're a part of SIPTU, you're swallowed up, you know. I never found it necessary. When I left the press, I finished my trade union membership, and I never found it necessary since I've been in the council to join a union. I made an attempt, and they had no place for a graphic designer. It's all grade ones and grade twos and grade threes. So I had a bit of laugh with that, you know. No place. I'm a no name.
John McAleer here in a quite a busy office and quite a busy street outside the County Council buildings here in South County Dublin in Clondalkin. Thank you very much indeed.
And thank you too. It was a pleasure.